91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Every investor knows that the stock market is inherently risky, but what if there's been deliberate wrongdoings? Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. In the next hour, we visit with New York City-based attorney Jacob Zamansky. His firm specializes in unscrupulous financial activity. Being cheated on stock investments often results in ruined retirement plans or forces bankruptcy. The list of impropriety is long. It includes unsuitable investments, fraud and misrepresentation, the practice of churning, and unauthorized trading. Even elder abuse could be involved. That's next. Stay with us. First, this news. And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Well, in the next hour, we take on the subject of stock investment fraud and other illegalities. How can an investor know if reported losses are on the up and up?
And what recourse does one have if suspicions arise? Joining us now to explain what constitutes improprieties is New York City-based securities fraud attorney Jake Zamansky. He's an expert on such matters, and he joins us. Welcome to you, Jake.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. So you write that investors do more due diligence in deciding which kind of dishwasher to buy than they do in reviewing their investment accounts or investigating the stockbroker who's handling their retirement or life savings. So I thought we'd start out by how to choose the right broker. Where do we start?
Okay, here's where you start. You have to find a broker that understands your investment goals and needs and fulfills them. It sounds simple, but I see a lot of times it doesn't happen. If you're a conservative investor, if you're retired, let's say somebody in Florida, you've got to make sure that your broker is not somebody that's putting you into high-risk stocks like tech stocks that can go up and down and bonds that can default. So you got to make sure that there's a connection between you and the broker. A lot of people find brokers from friends, from relatives. It's important once you find somebody to do your homework and do your due diligence.
Okay, so how do we do that? You talk about there's a website actually where we can find out if a stockbroker has had an action taken against them.
Yes, FINRA is the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. They're charged with regulating all stockbrokers in the country. And if someone, a stockbroker, has had customer complaints, been sued by customers, been charged with fraud by regulators, it's very easy to find that information. So if the stockbroker's name is John Jones, you go on FINRA's website. It's FINRA, FINRA.org, broker check. Check up your broker, just like you would if you were going to hire a bus driver to drive your kids. Look at his driving record. Very, very important to find the broker's record on BrokerCheck.
I was interested to see that you also recommend that you make sure that your stockbroker hasn't filed for bankruptcy. That would be sort of an obvious incompetency.
Everything about the broker that's significant is on this BrokerCheck that I mentioned. Have they been sued by customers? Have regulators gone after them? Have they filed for bankruptcy? Very often, when I see things like churning, brokers trying to, you know, get extra commissions from a customer by turning over his account, moving him from one product to another, there's usually a motivation. Let's say the broker's filed for bankruptcy. It's a sign that he's irresponsible with his own money. If the broker's just recently had a divorce and has had a big financial exposure, they're more likely to do improper things to generate the money they need for their own lifestyle. So it's important to keep an eye on your broker.
You represent individuals who've been taken advantage of by unscrupulous or negligent stockbrokers, But my question really concerns liability. How do we know if a broker is unscrupulous or negligent, or if he or she is just doing their job honestly, but doesn't do it so well and makes bad choices honestly?
Good question. You can't sue a broker for the market going in the opposite direction the broker thinks. If the market's going up and he thinks it's going down or vice versa, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, and I'll use a couple of terms that we use in my business, unsuitable investments. If you're the retired conservative person I mentioned a moment ago, let's say you're in your 70s or 80s, you're retired, you're in Florida, you're living off of the income from your account. You've worked all your life and you've got your nest egg. Let's say it's $500,000, $1 million you're going to live off of, and you're going to live off of the interest. Now, people are living long lives these days. A lot of people live into their 90s and beyond. So if you're 70 and retired, that money that you saved is irreplaceable money. You can't go back to work. You can't make it over again. So the broker has to understand that and put you in investments that are not risky. If you're in Puerto Rico bonds or Greek bonds that we've seen in the last couple days, you could have lost 25 or more percent of your investments. You may not be able to sell them. These are municipal bonds. There are many other examples I could use, but what I'm saying is the broker who recommends something that's too risky for a conservative investor has made what we call an unsuitable recommendation. Somebody like me, and I deal with it all the time, I can look at your portfolio in 5 or 10 minutes and speaking to you and looking at your portfolio and say, hey, there's a disconnect. You're conservative. This is risky. That's not right.
What if the broker mismanages the account based on a lack of due diligence by the client? In other words, you say you're talking to somebody, they're conservative, they're invested in aggressive stocks, but they haven't checked their statement. They don't know that that's going on because they're ignorant about and don't even know how to read their statement. Are they still at fault, the broker, or is the investor at fault?
Well, let's parse it out. The legal duty lies with the broker. When you go to a doctor, you hurt your arm, you're going to a doctor for advice. He's the professional. Same thing with accountants. When you go to a professional, a doctor, an accountant, a lawyer, a stockbroker, you're paying them for their services, and you expect a certain high quality of care. So realistically and legally, the broker has the responsibility to do the right thing. It's not the customer's responsibility to make sure the broker understood him and did the right thing. It's the broker's responsibility. Having said that, in order to avoid massive losses and huge problems, I tell customers, do your homework, check up on the broker. Ms. Berman, I've seen so many bad brokers, Florida, New York, California, and all over. I've been spending a lot of time in Puerto Rico. So many bad brokers, harming so many retirees and elderly people. So I say to people, check up on your broker. Go on broker check, see if there's a problem. Look at your monthly statement when they come in. If you see a trade that you said, boy, the guy just bought me an oil stock. I never wanted an oil stock. Why would he do that? Go call up the broker, find out about it. Call the manager if the broker is not being, you know, candid, or if he's being evasive. So yes, it's the broker's responsibility to do the right thing. But my feeling is the customer should check up on the broker and make sure they're not doing the wrong thing. And if they see a problem, talk to the manager or go to a securities lawyer like me.
If you have a client who has been harmed, and you take the case on, and of course it is on contingency, are these cases normally settled or do they go to court?
Okay. I represent investors all over the country, and I do it on a contingency for a couple of reasons, usually a third of the recovery. Number one, I want to have the same financial interest as my client. If the client gets back money, he gets most of it, I get some of it. If the client does not succeed, neither of us get anything. So I like to have the same financial interest. I select my cases carefully. Most important decision I choose is what clients to take on. If somebody has a good case, it's going to end well. If it's a bad case, I'm not sure I want to get involved.
So what? Let me just stop you there.
Sure.
What determines a good case and what determines a bad case?
Okay, a good case would be an elderly or retired person who, let's say, kept notes of what they told the broker to do. I want to be conservative. Broker puts them into risky investments, loses a substantial portion of their retirement savings. That's a good case. A case that maybe is not so good is someone who, let's say a working person making a nice living, wants to be aggressive, gets aggressive stocks, loses money, and complains against the broker. Well, look, you wanted to be aggressive. You wanted to roll the dice and take extra risk. It's hard to blame the broker when that's what you want to do. If it looks like you're very experienced and you've done the same type of trading, let's say in other firms, you're suing a Merrill Lynch or a Morgan Stanley, but yet you've been doing the same type of trading yourself on E-Trade and Fidelity, it's a hard case to make blaming the broker.
Okay, so let me ask you, we have this large elderly population, obviously, in South Florida. What can be done for them if they've been defrauded by a broker, but they're of diminished capacity or they're just incapable of following their financial statements? They've gotten to that point. What can be done for them? Does someone have to
look? I see a lot of that.
Okay.
Well, their relatives, you know, if you're, let's say, a grandson or daughter and your grandmother, you know, you walk into their house and you see a bunch of statements from Merrill Lynch or UBS, it's a red flag. Take a look at those statements, open them up, try and figure out, it's usually on the front page, we've lost, you know, $300,000 in the last 6 months. What's going on? So help your relatives if they're, you know, please check up on your relatives. Go in and visit them regularly. It's a good thing to do, but also to make sure that they're not losing money. So go in and look at them, and then call somebody like me. I talk to people all the time. I've got a lot of information on my website, Zamansky.com, Zamansky.com. You can look at it. You can send me an email. And then to answer your question, what happens with these cases? We file them at FINRA. There are three arbitrators appointed. You can go in front of the arbitrators, tell your story. The brokerage firm tells their story, and the arbitrators make a decision.
Okay. And so if they decide that this person has been defrauded in some way, what happens?
Okay, if the arbitrators, let's say somebody lost $1 million at Merrill Lynch, and they come to a lawyer like me, we bring a case against Merrill Lynch, and we show that there's this disconnect that I mentioned, an unsuitable investment, you're conservative, they were risky, and the arbitrators, you know, accept your story, and we've got evidence to prove it, they will issue an award, and the firm, like a major firm like Merrill or UBS, is required by FINRA rules to pay the award within 30 days. So it happens very quickly, much quicker than going to court, I can tell you.
And they can't
appeal? The
question
was asked about settlements. Most of these cases tend to settle.
What if it's an independent stockbroker?
Well, that's another reason to be careful who you're dealing with. I've seen, you know, independent stockbrokers that hang up a shingle, Fred Smith stockbroker, and he's putting in his trades through an E-Trade or Fidelity. That's a little dangerous. The people that are called registered investment advisors. Would you go to a doctor who may not have insurance, who isn't part of a practice or a hospital network, you know, for services? I'd be concerned about dealing. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but please check those people out carefully, because if you have a problem and you sue them, there may be nothing to collect.
We're speaking with Jake Zamansky. He's a securities fraud attorney specializing in financial services arbitration and class action litigation. We're going to take a short break on today's topical currents, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. We're speaking with securities fraud attorney Jacob Zamansky. Jacob, when does a broker cross the line from an active account to churning?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, if we're talking about individual investors, and particularly retirees and elderly people, there's really not much reason
to
do a lot of trading.
Could you define the term first of churning?
Sure. Churning means engaging in excessive trading in an account solely for the purpose of generating additional fees or commissions for the broker, turning it over, buying and selling, buying and selling, buying and selling. Most people don't really have the time, interest, or knowledge to engage in that kind of activity. So when you get confirmation slips in the mail, every time the broker does a buy or a sell, a slip comes in the mail, and then it's reflected on your monthly statement. So if you see 5, 10, 20 monthly, 20 confirmations coming in the mail, ask yourself, did I tell this broker to do that? If the answer is no, he could be churning you. He could be doing these trades just to generate commissions. It's a huge red flag. So if you get those statements in the mail, please look at them and ask yourself, did I order this transaction or not? Talk to the broker, and if he's saying, well, I thought this was a good idea for you, that's not right. The broker must call you every single time before he or she does a trade.
Jake, speaking of fees, how do we know if we're being charged a fair amount? I mean, some people get charged by the trade, like you say. Some people get charged a percentage. Are there guidelines or standards as to how much we should be charged?
Well, there's generally two types of fees that brokers charge. So the first is, you know, per trade. Let's say I have $1 million at Morgan Stanley Merrill Lynch, you know, my account sits there, I'm happy with the stocks. Well, I shouldn't be charged anything, okay? If I'm on a commission-based account, that broker charges commission every time they do a trade. If you do five trades a year, you should be charged some small commissions for five trades. A lot of brokers will say, no, I want to handle your account on a fee-based account. You have $1 million, they generally charge 1% of the assets. Now, that sounds like a small amount, but if I have $1 million in stocks and bonds and I'm well diversified and the account just sits there, so that broker's charging me 1% or $10,000 a year on a well-managed account. The second year they charge another $10,000 and so on. So if you have to ask yourself, what kind of a customer am I? Am I going to be doing a lot of trades? Am I going to be doing a few? Ask the broker for a comparison. Tell me what the fees will be, whether it's on a commission or, as we say, a fee-based account. It's an individualized discussion you have to have based on your needs and the type of activities you're going to be involved in.
Well, let's invite our listeners to join in the conversation. Have you done your due diligence in choosing your stockbroker? Do you know anything about them? Do you read and follow your monthly statements? Do you know of an elderly relative being taken advantage of? Well, give us a call, 1-800-743-9576, if you have a question for Jake Zamansky, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email us, radio@WLRN.org.
Jake, how is the risk profile of a client created?
Okay. When you meet with a broker, just like when you meet with a doctor for the first time, they ask you questions about your health and so forth. So when you meet with a broker, they have a legal obligation to understand your financial situation, your investment experience, and your tax status and other things. So if I'm a retired investor, I'm in my 70s living with my spouse in Florida, been retired for 5 or so years, the broker is supposed to sit down and interview you and ask you questions. You know, how old are you? When did you retire? How much money do you have? How much money do you need on an annual basis? What kind of risk are you comfortable with? Sometimes they'll have a chart from 1 to 10, high risk to very low risk. It's called qualification of the investor. So you really have to have this good conversation with them. They've got to write it down. Sometimes they give you a questionnaire. And what I find problematic often is the broker will just be filling out a questionnaire himself. And You know, sometimes if he thinks he's going to, you know, push high-risk products, he'll check high-risk when you're not really that way. Or sometimes he'll ask you to sign a form in blank. Just sign here. I'll fill it in later. Don't go for that. Walk out the door. Ask for a copy. I want to see the risk profile in that you put down for me, because I'm conservative. I want to make sure that your records reflect that I'm conservative. If I'm moderate, I want to see that it's moderate. So you have this qualification meeting. A lot of times it's on the phone. All right, that's okay, but get a copy of it and make sure it's consistent with what you want him to do.
Do many clients divide their investment to say, well, I certainly want to have a nest egg and retire, but you can take X amount of money and invest that in more high-risk ventures?
Yeah, let's say I have $1 million and I'm, let's say I'm in my 50s. You know, I'm going to retire in 10 years from now, but I'm not there yet. So I might say, look, keep 80% of this safe, let's say in a bond portfolio, municipal bonds. But 20%, you can be a little more aggressive. You want to buy some stocks, you know, you think you're going to take a chance on a, I'll use an example, Tesla or Google or Apple or something. Okay, but I'm only going to allow you to use 10%, maybe 20% of my account. And I want to document it. I want to see a letter, an instruction, or something confirming, you know, what's the, what I'll call play money.
You know, you just mentioned municipal bonds, and of course, I guess most of us have been following the situation in Puerto Rico, and I know you've been working there and you've been involved there for some time. But if municipal bonds are safe and people invested in municipal bonds in Puerto Rico, do they have any recourse now?
Yeah, Puerto Rico is a huge mess. I had never been to Puerto Rico before 2013. And I've made about 15 trips since then. I'll be back there next week. I represent hundreds of investors, mostly customers of UBS, Puerto Ricans, and also Puerto Ricans that have moved to the States, to Orlando's a place where a lot of them are living. And those people, it's really tragic, Bonnie. They were told that these were safe and secure municipal bonds, that there was no risk. A lot of these people were retirees or disabled people living off of the interest. So again, if I saved $1 million all my life and it's generating interest, you know, let's say $5,000 a month I'm using as interest, that's fine. But I'm hoping that $1 million will be there. That's my, you know, rainy day money. That's the money I want to pass on to my heirs. Well, what's happened in Puerto Rico in 2013, the summer of 2013, those bonds went down over 50% in value, and that's tragic, a 50% loss. Think of anybody if you lost 50% of your nest egg. Well, guess what? They're about to lose even more. Puerto Rico, the governor of Puerto Rico, is asking to be able to file for bankruptcy. They're not allowed to do that. They're a territory. Detroit, we know in 2013, filed for bankruptcy, a major city. So if you had bonds of a Puerto Rico or Detroit, or some other states, Illinois is in trouble, the bonds are only as good as the issuer, the company or the country that issues the bonds. So you got to be careful. You know, Florida is generally good, New York, California. California has a lot of financial problems. Florida does as well. So you've got to ask your broker and do homework online. What's the risk profile of the bonds that I'm holding? Very important. They're not all safe.
So these people that did invest and have lost at least 50% and now it's going to be more, how are they going to recover their losses if they're bankrupt?
Well, here's the story. First of all, they're not bankrupt, but that's what I've been talking about. The brokerage firm that sold them, most of them were sold by UBS. There are some other banks, but the lion's share was UBS. UBS, according to these customers, told them that these were safe and secure investments, and we're going to prove in cases that UBS knew that wasn't true, that the rating agencies, Moody's, S&P, and Fitch, had downgraded these bonds, that reports were being issued by UBS and other firms saying that they were becoming very risky. Mm. Well, that was never told to a lot of people. So, yes, we're suing UBS for misrepresentation, fraud, and unsuitable investments, and we're recovering money back for people. either through settlements or to going to arbitration. So, yeah, we're working hard, my whole firm, helping the people in Puerto Rico.
We have some calls. We're speaking with Jake Szymanski, a securities fraud attorney specializing in financial services arbitration class action litigation. And we're going to take this short break. When we come back, we'll have more and we'll take your calls. Stay with us. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jake Szymanski, a securities fraud attorney specializing in financial services arbitration and class action litigation. He's a leading authority on securities arbitration law, and that's the recourse for investors claiming broker wrongdoing. Just one question, we'll go to the calls, but what if a customer in South Florida, let's say, has their stockbroker in New York, and they want to go through one of these FINRA arbitration cases? Who goes where? Do they have to travel now, especially an elderly person? They have to travel to New York to do this?
No. One of the good things about FINRA is we do the arbitrations in the area where the customer resides. So if the customer's in Florida, the broker's in New York, the broker has to come down and face justice at an arbitration in Florida.
Oh, okay.
And we will be taking some calls. Our number 1-800-743-9576. Before we do go to calls, a brief disclaimer. Mr. Szymanski is not giving specific legal advice to anyone, but just general information for all of our elucidation. Next up, it's first up, actually, it's Eileen in Miami. Hi.
Hi, Mr. Szymanski. A relative of my family, a relative of mine, passed away, and it wasn't until his death that we realized, when we looked at, you know, at his holdings, what had been going on with the broker at Wells Fargo. And we have gone to everybody trying to show them what happened, and they have all said, well, because you are beneficiaries, this is really more of a family matter, and we really are not going to get involved. So how do people, like, make these complaints unless they and get heard if the only way they find out is by, after somebody passes away?
Well, I disagree with those other folks that you spoke to. If there's been wrongdoing by Wells Fargo with someone who passed away, a beneficiary or usually an executor is appointed to handle the affairs of the estate, you can file a FINRA arbitration in Florida, wherever the customer resides, and you can look back 6 years. There's a six-year eligibility rule. There are separate statute of limitations, which is a different issue, but you should get in touch with a securities lawyer, bring that person the monthly statements of the elderly person, write up a profile, what they did. Were they somebody worked in a manufacturing plant? Were they ill? I see a lot of brokers taking advantage of elderly people, particularly people that are ill. It's really a disgusting thing, and there are elder abuse laws in many states. So right. I would get in there and see an attorney that specializes in securities arbitration. My firm does it. There are a lot of other firms. And get an opinion, but bring in those statements and tell them what the person was like. I had a case recently with a major firm where the broker literally was stealing from an elderly lady who was in the hospital. Some of these people have no conscience. They're all about money. So I would, exercise your rights. You have a legal right if you're the executor, beneficiaries. You can talk to the person, whoever's in charge. Get appointed as a legal representative of that estate, and then go see a lawyer.
I was wondering, Jake, if sometimes the small investor is preyed upon because there isn't such a great amount of money to make a big wave.
The small investors get very little attention from brokers, and that in and of itself is a problem. So, small investors don't get calls, the brokers don't make a lot from them, but if they're in risky investments or the market changes, they're exposed. And a lot of these firms are even saying, look, we're not going to waste our broker's time. You can go to a call center. you know, where it, like, you know, imagine being treated like somebody with a credit card problem. So small investors particularly have to do due diligence to make sure their smaller nest eggs are protected. I say they got to work a little harder because they're going to get less attention.
Again, our number, if you want to join in the conversation, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576 or radio@WLRN.org for email.
Next on our line is Karen in Loxahatchee. Hey, Karen. Karen, you're up.
Karen, are you there?
Okay. We'll move along to Rob in Boca Raton. Hi there.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Rob. There.
We have a really bad connection.
Sounds like Rob's on the I-95.
Yes.
In a convertible. Go ahead, Rob. We'll try you.
Okay. How you doing today?
Oh, good.
Okay. I wanted to just offer my opinion, I mean, my suggestions as a successful investor myself. I personally would never trust a broker. It's like going to buy a car. The salesperson's interests are their own. You're very secondary. And there's really no need for a broker. The way to do it is very simple. You get low-cost index funds, Fidelity or Vanguard. You buy when you can, and you don't sell until you need it. And you'd be very patient. It's really the best way to go. It's safe and it works.
Hmm. Jake, what do you think of that?
Well, I think Rob is a very intelligent, experienced investor who has the time and interest to manage his portfolio. Most people are not like Rob, so they do need brokers, but they need honest ones. I tend to agree that most of them are looking out for themselves. It's not right. You know, there are doctors who are supposed to be looking out for patients, but obviously they have to pay their own bills. Look, it's the system we have. If I'm working a 9-to-5 job, I come home and I want to relax, do I really have a lot of time to manage my own portfolio? The markets are so fast-moving.
Right, but
things change day to day.
I would disagree with that because a long-term investor should not even look at his portfolio on a regular basis.
Hmm.
And you do not need a wide variety. A couple low-cost index funds, you know, worry about in 10 years. People who look at the market too often on a regular basis, they get emotional. They sell at bad times.
Hmm.
It's, I think Rob has a point, but again... do you have ask yourself, do you have the time, do you have the knowledge, the experience to do this? It's not for the faint of heart or for, you know, for newcomers.
Let me ask you about this. An article in the New York Times by Alexandra Stevenson said that investors in hedge funds did not have a lucrative year in 2014, but for those who manage their money, the pay was spectacular and it gives this outrageous amount. How does that happen? And would those investors who didn't have a great year in their hedge funds have a case against their brokers?
Okay, let's talk about what a hedge fund is. I'm very concerned whenever I see a retail investor, I call them mom and pops in our business, ordinary people, in something like a hedge fund. A hedge fund is a very risky investment. You could lose all of your money. And you have a manager, and there's a lot of fraud. Bernie Madoff ran a hedge fund. We know what happened there. So you're giving almost blind control over your money to somebody. We hope he's good, but a lot of them are fraudulent. There was a Rothstein and a lot of other things in Florida.
Right.
Unfortunately, Florida attracts a lot of people, particularly from the East Coast and the North, who aren't so scrupulous. They start hedge funds. So I'm always worried about investors getting in a hedge fund. But let's talk about what the manager does. They generally charge, it's called 2-in-20. So if I put $1 million into a hedge fund, they automatically get 2% of the assets every year. It's $20,000, whether you do a good or bad. It's a lot of money. If you've got, some of these hedge funds have $1 billion in them, get 2% right off the top, whether it rains or shines. They get 20% of the profits. If you put in $1 million and it goes, let's say it doubles and goes to $2 million, they get $200,000. Okay, if it goes down, well, guess what? You're stuck. They still get their 2%. So don't worry about the hedge funds. They've got their yachts. They've got their Lamborghinis. those managers, worry about yourself and ask yourself, do I understand what I'm investing in? What's the risk? Private equity. You know, everybody says, oh, we're going to do a private equity investment and we're going to buy companies and buy, you know, beaten up bonds and you're going to profit. Usually it's the managers profiting. I don't know too many people that do well in these investments.
And we move along to Steve in Deerfield. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing, Greg?
Good.
I have a question for you about the Puerto Rico bonds. Are they were they insured? And if they're insured, what's the status of the claims on those?
That's a good question, Steve. Are they insured? Most of the time, they're not insured, okay? You have to purchase specific insurance. Now, some people do that, mostly institutions or a pension fund. But now, if you've looked at it, the stocks of the insurance companies have dropped dramatically. You know, when there's huge claims, which there could be if Puerto Rico defaults, like when we saw with Lehman Brothers in 2008 going bankrupt, one of the largest investment banks in the world, the insurers have problems. So generally, they're not insured, and most of the problems I'm seeing are people that have these Puerto Rican bonds stuffed in what's called a closed-end fund, like a closed-end mutual fund, usually issued by UBS. So those investments have done terribly in the last couple of years and are on the verge of another major leg down.
Got it. What about my understanding on bonds is that if you have a bond is insured, that automatically gives it a AAA rating.
Well, not necessarily. Ratings come from rating agencies like Fitch and Moody's, who look at the credit of these issuers, Puerto Rico, Greece, you know, California, and they say, well, what kind of expenses do they have and what kind of problems do they have? And if it's an excellent credit, let's say the United States of America, you know, that's a AAA. If it's Greece, it's beyond junk bonds. That's where Puerto Rico is. They're in the junk category. Junk is another term for high yield. Now, that blinds people. A lot of times they say, wow, but these Puerto Rican bonds are paying 8, 10%. That's tremendous. Well, guess what? There's tremendous risk associated with that. If you bought a bond for $100 and you're getting an 8% fabulous return most of the time, triple tax-free for Puerto Ricans, that bond may only be worth $50 now. So you got to be careful when you chase risk. When you chase return, I want high yield, you're often chasing risk.
We're speaking with Jake Szymanski, a securities fraud attorney, and our last break on Topical Currents. We'll come back and take more of your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jake Szymanski, a securities fraud attorney and one of the country's foremost authorities on securities arbitration law. So let's continue with our phone calls. By the way, the website, Jake, is Szymanski.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Joe, you want to take the next call?
Let's move along to Norma. Norma's in Hollywood. Hi.
Hi. Thank you both for taking my call. And Mr. Szymanski, and I love your show. Big supporter.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a question. I had a mother who passed away in 2010, and she had an account, I guess I shouldn't say that, one of the big trust companies. And my mother had dementia, and she gave away to these lottery fraud people over $500,000. And I went to that bank, that trust company, endlessly showing them money orders, et cetera, and, you know, threatening to sue them if they didn't get control. I didn't have power of attorney. I didn't have anything because she wouldn't give it. And, of course, they did nothing, and we lost quite a bit of money, and then they kept a huge amount of money for the next year, quote-unquote, settling an account that didn't even need to go to probate. What do you think? Is the statute of limitations done, and do I have any options at this point?
All right. Well, look, I would get in and see an attorney right away. Statute of limitations, as I mentioned, are a separate issue, and really you have to look at the particular facts of the case. But you have a six-year window in FINRA. Yours 2010. If you filed a case, you know, tomorrow at FINRA, you're within the eligibility period. It's a six-year period, depending on the facts of your case. So I think you go in and talk to an attorney as soon as possible. Let them relax over the 4th of July and see them after the holiday.
Okay, and how do I identify the right attorney? Because I sure tried and wasn't very successful at it.
Well, there's a website that I'll give you. It's PIABA.org. It's Public Investors Arbitration Bar Association, PIABA.org. A lot of lawyers there. They have a lawyer referral service that people that do work like me all over the country.
Thank you. Okay, I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. Good luck.
Jake Szymanski, perhaps you can clear this up for me. Exactly how does an unscrupulous broker profit from my losses? What's the chain? Are there kickbacks somewhere?
Well, that's a sinister thing, and, you know, sometimes there are kickbacks, but most of the time it's not that, you know, you're losing money and it goes in their pocket. It's mostly the commissions they charge you from putting you in unsuitable investments. And sometimes it's not a lot of money that the brokers make. It's more the harm that's caused, okay? Sometimes, you know, when you see a major industrial accident, it's not... You know, they might have left out a 5-cent screw. So a little mistake, a little lack of diligence can cause a lot of pain. It's the commissions that they charge where they'll put you into a high-fee product. Structured products is something that I've dealt with a lot. They're complex and opaque products. And brokers get paid a lot of money for pushing certain products. And a structured product is a combination between an option and a bond. It's complicated. If the broker's selling something you don't understand, I'd stay away from it. Those complicated products, we talked about hedge funds, private equity, real estate investment trusts, oil and gas drilling investments, structured products. These are complex products. They generally pay a much higher fee to the broker. They're very risky. So when you lose money, you get stuck holding the bag. The broker's gotten his money. He's already bought his, you know, new sports car.
And we'll take another call. This is Josette in Miami. Hi, go ahead.
First, I'd like to have a telephone number for those of us who are not very smart on the computer.
Okay, it's 212-742-1414.
My question is, I've worked with the same broker for 20 years, and when I turned 79, he put me into an annuity, which he told me would pay 6.3%. When the check arrived, I realized that what an annuity does is take your own money, give it back to you, and the percentage on it is a much lower amount. We've gone round and round about this. And what he's telling me is that he showed me all the illustrations. And because I've worked with him for 20 years and I implicitly trust him and I let him do all my investments, do I have a recourse? I'd like to get out of it, but I haven't been able to find it. Where to go, where to complain, how to handle this.
All right. Bonnie and Joe, this is a type of question I get a lot. This woman trusted her broker. Again, I don't know the broker or the customer, but...
He's with UBS.
Okay, well, can I ask you, how much do you think you paid for that annuity? How much did he charge you? You have any idea?
Yeah, I did ask about the commission. It was over $16,000.
Okay, it's usually 6%. So... if it's $100,000, they make $6,000. That's a lot of money
right,
to sell a product. And she doesn't seem to understand. He gave her some fancy illustrations. Again, I'm not casting any aspersions here. I would go in and talk to his manager.
I did say,
I want to talk to the manager. I'm unhappy, or I feel I didn't understand, or something wasn't explained to me.
I've done all
that. If you don't get
that.
Any satisfaction from the manager, go see one of these lawyers that do this work. Annuities are an area which is ripe for fraud. People don't understand them. A lot of brokers don't even understand what they're selling. They're complex, and she's right. She basically getting her own money back. And if it's not the interest rate, and by the way, if she gets out of that annuity, she's going to pay a huge, what we call, surrender charge.
Exactly.
You can't just sell it. You're going to get a huge haircut or hit. So I would get some satisfaction soon, either from the manager. 79 years old, she shouldn't be worrying like this. This is the type of problem that makes me very upset.
Thank you.
Okay, Josette.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Jake, are you currently representing any victims of Ponzi schemes? Do they still have Ponzi schemes post-Bernard Madoff?
Oh, God, I wish they weren't, but yes, we do. What I see is I see Ponzi schemes a lot all over the country. There's been a lot in Florida. And what they're generally, Bernie Madoff was, you know, the king of Ponzi. They should change the name of the scheme to Madoff. But I see it all over, and it's affinity crimes. You know, somebody in the Italian community taking advantage of Italians, Indians. I saw somebody at a church, believe it or not, taking advantage of the church. I've helped put some people in jail. I contact the authorities. I sue the banks that these folks were affiliated with. I've gotten money back all over the country for people in Ponzi schemes. Unfortunately, it's all too prevalent. Again, it's one of those areas where they're fast-talking people. They gain your trust because, you know, you're a member of that particular ethnic community or a church or some institution, and you trust this person, and they give you phony paperwork. That's another problem. Look at the paperwork you're getting, you know, that represents your investments. There are a lot of Ponzi schemes. The authorities are playing catch-up ball. I never see the feds or the state regulators get these people ahead of time. Usually it's after people's lives have been destroyed. Hmm. So be very careful. If you're not sure what you're dealing with, if you're not dealing with a bank, you may be in a Ponzi scheme.
Well, we don't have much time left, but I noticed that you didn't begin on this side of the law. You actually didn't always represent investors. So what caused you to come over to the other side?
Okay, I have to say, I started doing this work in the 1980s. In the 1990s, I was hired by some of the worst brokers in New York, Long Island. And if you remember the movie The Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio,
of course,
played Jordan Belfort, I was the lawyer for that guy and that firm. And I did very well getting them away with murder and mayhem in the 90s, going to arbitrations and defending this company. I enjoyed it. I learned the business, but I didn't like what I was doing. I didn't like these people. But I learned all of the dirty tricks of Wall Street. And what I found was that what those boiler rooms, we call them, were doing, I saw at the highest levels of some of the top Wall Street firms. So in 1998, I had had enough. I switched sides, and I took my knowledge and experience to represent investors, having seen the worst of the worst and the dirty tricks they play. So that's what's informed my judgment and practice.
Well, we want to thank you, and I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Jake Zemanski, securities fraud attorney specializing in financial services, arbitration, class action litigation. His firm is Zemanski LLC. It's in New York. It's Zemanski.com. And again, I'll give the phone number. It's 212-742-1414 for those who don't have a computer. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure, Jake.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Bye.
And we hope you learned a bit from our program. It was produced by Paulie Landris with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Lead producer Richard Ives with assistance as well. Be sure to tune in for tomorrow's program if you consider yourself technologically challenged. We have a repeat program with popular technology writer David Pogue. He gives tips and insight which make the mystifying terribly obvious. Whether it's your phone to PCs, pods, digital cameras, most everyone will learn something. We have free audio archive and downloads of this and past programs at our website, that's WLRN.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.